Welcome, everybody. This is Diana Oblinger, President of EDUCAUSE, and you're participating in the EDUCAUSE Analytics Sprint. And first of all, I want to thank our sponsors because the sprint is made possible by a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and sponsored by IBM and EDUCAUSE Silver Partner. Now, as you may know, this is the second day of a three-day sprint, and a sprint is an intense set of 3 days of online activities that are designed to discuss analytics. And in addition to this webinar, we've got lots of other activities. We've got guest bloggers, Twitter, IdeaScale, and community polls, and that will add a lot of depth to the discussion that we're going to begin just about now. And I do hope that you take advantage of all that the Sprint has to offer, not just the webinar. There's a lot of information on the Sprint website, and you'll find your way from there to lots of really useful resources. Now, just one other note about this webinar, and that is that it's designed to be interactive, and we've got lots and lots of people to interact with. And there are two areas I want you to note. On the left-hand side of your screen is a large chat space. And that's where we would like you to share information with each other, make comments, post URLs, link to resources. That's where we want you to put your general comments. And then underneath that main screen where you see the slides, there's another chat box that says submit a question for the speaker. That's where we would really like for you to put your questions. We will answer as many questions as we can today. I'm sure we won't get to all of them, but that's where to put your questions, and we'll be pulling those as we go along. Now, in between those two pods, there's a roster. And that's the list of attendees. And if you want to send a private message to someone, hover your cursor over their name and select Start Private Chat. Now, there is a really important name on that roster that I want you to take note of, and it's technical help. So if you have any questions, need technical assistance, just send a private message to technical help. And if you want to be joining us in the back channel and tweet, the hashtag is EduSprint, EDUSPRINT. And as many of you know, the slides and the entire session will be archived and available on the Sprint website later on today. Now, just a little bit about the Sprint and what we've done so far. As you know, we began the Sprint with President Freeman Hrabowski from University of Maryland, Baltimore County yesterday, and he provided an overview of analytics. And I hope lots of you were able to join us because it was a really nice session. We've got lots of resources that people talked about being required for analytics, talked about how you get them, how you do the return on investment, about outcomes of analytics initiatives, how you communicate that with stakeholders, and where analytics ultimately takes an institution. And one of the words of where it takes you is the innovation. And that entire session is archived on the Sprint website for your convenience, and you may have seen the newsletter that came to you this morning. And in the newsletter, there are all kinds of highlights and links to yesterday's activities. Today, we're going to focus on how analytics can inform learning. Marcia Lovett is going to speak first, and she's going to address the faculty experience with analytics, and Ellen Wagner is going to share lessons learned from a project that involves literally hundreds of thousands of student records. And tomorrow, I hope you will sign up to join us again tomorrow, we're going to focus on operational considerations with the University of Washington and Arizona State University. But let's talk about today's webinar, and that is on analytics for teaching, learning, and student success. And, of course, analytics provides a way to monitor learner activity and progress, as well as to predict outcomes and give students a heads up if there are any problems. And learning analytics really does enable all kinds of interventions and decision making, both by instructors as well as for students. And analytics can provide feedback to faculty and course designers. I think you're going to hear about that. And that allows them to make targeted improvements to course material. It can also predict student performance, providing alerts to students when their patterns indicate that they might be in trouble of poor performance. And, of course, in other cases, faculty or advisors can be alerted to potential problems that allow them to intervene and provide specific types of assistance to the students right when and where they need them. Today we're going to be joined by two absolutely outstanding experts, and they've got a lot to offer in this area. First of all, let me introduce Dr. Marcia Lovett. Marcia is the director of the Everly Center for Teaching Excellence and a teaching professor in the Department of Psychology at Carnegie Mellon University. And she has done a lot to help instructors improve their teaching. And her research has studied all kinds of areas like learning, memory, problem solving. She's developed computation models for strategy selection, skill acquisition, working memory, more than 50 research articles, a couple of books that are really interesting, one called Thinking with Data and another one about how learning works. So if you don't hear enough from Marcia today, maybe you will want to get those books and take a look at them. We are also joined by Dr. Ellen Wagner, and Ellen is the Executive Director for the WICHE Cooperative for Educational Technologies, or WCET. She's also a member of the Predictive Analytics Reporting Project. And Ellen has a very diverse, outstanding background, both in business and academia. Her corporate background includes having served at Adobe and Macromedia. And prior to her corporate role, she was a tenured professor and administrator at the University of Northern Colorado. So Ellen has been on both sides of higher education, if you will. And we are going to start with Marcia and learn more about her work and the analytics initiatives underway at Carnegie Mellon. Marcia, over to you.
Thank you so much, Diana, and thank you all for joining us today. I am just delighted to share my work with you and especially with this audience, because learning analytics is such an important new direction for so many of us. And speaking of this audience, I guess my first question is a polling question to know who you all are in terms of your primary role, administrator, maybe IT professional, professor, or something else. So I'll kind of let those roll in. We'll see who all is represented in today's sprint. Okay. Well, I'm going to take that as a pretty good representation. I don't know if everyone can see the numbers. There were the largest set was IT professionals, but there were also quite a few administrators and professors among our group today. I myself am an administrator here at Carnegie Mellon in my role at the Teaching Center, and I'm also a professor. And I would say from both of those roles, I've been thinking a lot about the following question. If we could go back to my slides. Thank you. This question has intrigued me. From both the role of administrator, how faculty's courses are going, and the role of a professor myself, how is my own course going? How are my students learning? Are my instructional strategies working? And I find this question really intriguing because it's critical to understand how things are going in order to improve our teaching and our students' learning. The thing is, most of the time we don't have clear indicators or evidence to know how our courses really are going. So I just was curious what the audience thinks about this question. If you're a faculty member, you can take on this question from that perspective and try to think about how do you know, how do you gauge how your course is going? I put up a few options there, including it's often rather hard to tell. If you are in another role that's not quite instructor or faculty role, maybe you could think about this from the student perspective or from the administrator perspective. We'll see how those roll in. So as I can see, a lot of folks are saying by the feel, discussions, participations, and I think it is kind of interesting that a lot of times we have to make this judgment just by feel. I'll let that roll in a little bit longer. Looking like it's holding pretty steady there, that's one of the most popular responses. Okay. Well, as I said, answering this question, how is my course going? How are my students learning? How are my instructional activities working the way I hoped they would? These questions are related to the next thing I want to share with you. It's actually a result that I think relates to those questions and that challenge behind them. I actually find this result rather shocking, and it's from a study I conducted. I was analyzing the learning of students in an introductory statistics course here at Carnegie Mellon. The particular numbers, the results I'll show you next, it's from this particular study with one Carnegie Mellon professor and one Carnegie Mellon course, but I should say that the basic result holds and surprisingly enough, has been observed in a variety of courses, a variety of universities, and with a variety of professors. Here it is. The result is that students spend more than 100 hours across the term, semester, and yet, in this course, show learning gains of only 3%. So we gave them a pre-test, post-test, and found that even though they spent all that time, they really did not gain that much. And I think of all the person hours that went into that. Like I said, I do find this rather shocking. Maybe you do too. Now, I'm also guessing at this point you might be wondering or maybe hoping that this was because, oh, it was just one of those dry lecture courses with a not-so-engaging professor, and so we can kind of attribute the result to those kinds of features. Well, nope. As it turned out, this course was being taught by an award-winning professor, and each week the students attended three rather lively lectures, and once a week they attended a computer lab session where they did hands-on data analysis exercises with the computer working in pairs. So really this was not easily attributable to some rather archaic or old-fashioned approaches, and yet we did see this unfortunate 3% gain. I will be talking more about the baseline numbers, and I'm going to come back to this study toward the end of my session. But I think we can improve on that, and I think one of the ways we can do that is with learning analytics. But actually, I think that is a part of the solution. And so I want to pose this question to keep people thinking about learning analytics and how we want to really engage in learning analytics in our work. Like I said, it is an important part of the solution. And what I'm arguing and what I want to show you in the work that I'm presenting today is that when those learning analytics are combined with and incorporate cognitive theory on how students learn, that's when we really can see the value come through. So how are learning analytics tending to be conducted these days? Well, the typical approach is to emphasize prediction. That is, what can we glean from the data to predict something about a student's next action, next choice, time when they might have difficulty. And that can be very useful in triggering some action on the part of faculty or administrators. But that kind of modeling might not give us deep insights, and more importantly, might not give us sufficient guidance on what we should do differently to make things better. Now, in many situations, prediction is enough. You don't care a lot about the underlying model. You care about a result. But in many important teaching and learning situations, we do care about the model, and we want to seek inferences about how this teaching and learning system works. While we may not have the model that we believe in all its precise details, we want to have confidence that it represents a good approximation to reality so that we can derive meaningful inferences. And really, what I would say is go from prediction and understanding to making some really targeted actions that help our students' learning be the best it can be. And that's really what my work has been focused on, how to support faculty members and students in making learning the best it can be. And I've been building learning analytics into a system that can make accurate and meaningful inferences from the data. But what is the situation now? The situation now is really that instructors could benefit from having up-to-date and actionable information. A few examples of this. Wouldn't it be great if you're a professor and you had a quick snapshot of how your class is doing that goes beyond your feel from class discussions or participation? Wouldn't it be great if you had access further to the details on students' areas of strength and difficulty, that you got some alerts to noteworthy patterns in student learning, and even to help you out, had some pointers for opportunities as to how you might adapt your teaching to the students' learning. Unfortunately, the best kind of typical situation is that instructors have access to averages or distributions of students' scores on graded activities. So in a large lecture, you might have students' scores coming back to you after the quiz or after the recent unit test. And here you can see this distribution shows that the average was around 80%, but what does that mean? Does that mean that everybody in the class got the same 80% right and the same 20% wrong? Or did 80% of the students do a really great job and 20% really poorly? Or all of the possible combinations in between? The problem with this situation is that the implications are rather coarse and hard to draw out of this kind of data. Moreover, the results tend to come late. That is, you get the quiz or exam scores after the unit is completed. So the situation is not that different from students' point of view. Students also could really benefit from up-to-date, actionable information, a quick snapshot of how that student is doing, access to details on his or her areas of strength and difficulty, similar alerts to what's going on, and pointers to opportunities they could use to adapt their learning. That would be great. Unfortunately, the current situation tends to be that students get a grade, and the grade is the thing they focus on, and in turn, they miss out on the opportunity to learn from a performance assessment or a learning activity that has that kind of a grade. What we tend to see, especially with the underclassmen in college situations, is that there's an emotional response to a grade that may be not very productive, that students don't necessarily have a reason or an incentive to go back and remediate because they're already moving on to the next topic. And even if they wanted to do something about it, oftentimes students don't know what they should do next to help address any shortcomings that a performance assessment revealed in their learning. So from this point, what we really want is we want a system that can take advantage of the data that are available, especially data that are available coming out of online learning experiences, to really help instructors and students get the up-to-date, actionable information they need. So I'm arguing that what we want is an understanding not just of what students have done, but of students' learning states. That's how we can really address these things most effectively as faculty members, and what we need to do that is learning analytics informed by cognitive theory. The project I'm working on, the project that we've been developing here at Carnegie Mellon, is called the Learning Dashboard to accomplish this. And just to give you a quick overview, the Learning Dashboard uses a sophisticated model of students' learning states to analyze the clickstream data that come from students interacting with online learning objects. It does that analysis in real time in order to provide useful and interpretable inferences, recommendations, and data visualizations for students and instructors. And like I said, this is a different approach. It adds another layer beyond what most learning analytics systems do. They tend to track what students have done in terms of performance, maybe record the questions students got right or wrong, summarize progress, and predict some future behavior. But what I really want to highlight is that the learning dashboard really from its cognitively informed models can draw more out of the data to reveal what students understand, to quantify how well students have learned each skill, and also to identify consequential patterns in learning behavior, maybe even to support metacognitive skill development, and also to help us by measuring the effectiveness of instructional design choices. So those are some of the advantages that the learning dashboard offers. How do we do that? Well, I'm just going to give you a glimpse in the short time we have together of the key ingredients, the special sauce that we put in there to do this. And one of those is cognitive and learning theory, and the other is state-of-the-art statistical models. So just to give you a little bit on the cognitive and learning theory that we've incorporated into the learning dashboard, this is my area of expertise, and what I really wanted to do was take advantage of the decades of research, the rather large and deep literature on how people learn. And just one of the key ideas from that literature that is incorporated into the learning dashboard is the idea that learning is skill specific. The idea here is it's not total practice in a domain that determines how well students will perform on a given task, but the practice at each individual skill that matters for learning. When that same skill is practiced, performance improves, and we have, like Diana mentioned in her introduction, computational models that capture the nature of that performance improvement, but it is skill specific. And the reference I like to make to remind people of how this makes sense, after all, is we used to have students study Latin in college. Why? Because the mind is a muscle, and studying Latin will strengthen that muscle and then, of course, make you better at geometry and writing and all kinds of deep thought. But we know that that general breadth of transfer isn't the way the mind works, and so really building in this skill specificity of learning can be key to making the most use of the data. So we start from a core architecture of cognition and build a quantitative cognitive model of skill learning that helps us dig deeper into the features of student learning than you could get by just looking at raw performance. So that just gives you a quick overview of the cognitive and learning side of the learning dashboard. The other piece I wanted to give you a window onto is the statistical modeling side. And this is really a great opportunity because when you have big data, you need to have models and statistical sophistication to match. And I'm sure we're going to be hearing more about that from Ellen in her presentation that follows. In terms of the learning dashboard, we have built into the system a Bayesian hierarchical modeling approach. The nice thing about this is it captures multiple components of variation in the data to make sharper inferences. And remember, the variable of interest here, students' learning states, is not directly observable. So it's a latent variable that we want to make inference about as best as possible from the data we have. With the Bayesian hierarchical modeling approach, we get more accurate inferences about students' learning states as data accrue. So that's one really good thing, that we have improvements in our inferences the more data we get. And we know the way online learning systems are going, there are more and more data coming in with the richness of experiences that students have there. The other thing about Bayesian hierarchical models is that they enable borrowing strengths, that is, across students, classes, and populations to improve the precision and the generalizability of the inferences we can make from the data. So let me give you a quick example of that. Let's say I'm a student in a single online course, and the learning dashboard is getting data on my individual interactions with the system. It could make inferences about my learning from just my interactions alone, and that would be good, but even better, it can make inferences about my learning based on my interactions that are also informed by the general similar patterns of learning that the model has inferred from the set of students who have been working in that same course my semester and maybe over past semesters. So more similar students to me can further improve the precision of estimates about my learning. So that's another benefit of the learning dashboards approach. And finally, I just wanted to mention that with these large data sets and these sophisticated models and cognitive models, we do need to include sophisticated algorithms in order to enable efficient computation. And really to get those analyses and those results back to the users quickly and efficiently. What I wanted to do next, since I've given you some background on the learning dashboard and the sort of theory behind it, is I wanted to give you a bit of the user experience. So I'm going to show you some slides next that really walk you through what a student and then professor might experience when working in a course that is hooked into the learning dashboard. So let's start with a student who's doing some online learning here, working on an instructional activity and drawing on whatever knowledge and skills he has to, say, answer the question that's going on. The knowledge that that student is drawing on may be correct or incorrect, strong or weak, we don't know. And that's what the bubble above his head with the question mark is saying. Right now, before the student does anything, we don't know what is this student's learning state for each of the skills that need to be used in this domain. So the student actually now in this screen has done some interaction, and you can see from the left-hand side, the data from that interaction are automatically pushed up to the cloud where the learning dashboard model can estimate the student's learning state on several skills. And we just have a very simple diagram here of four particular skills about in this current domain. And the idea is, like I said, the more data accrue, the more up-to-date and accurate that estimated learning state can be. So you can see that over time, the student's actual learning state on the right would be mirrored or reflected in the learning dashboard's estimates. Now, the model and the learning dashboard can use that estimate then to communicate to the student, to send back information that says not just you got this question right or wrong, but to share there was a pattern in the right and wrong answers you made such that we see you're doing pretty well in this skill area, but actually there's some work you could do on this other skill, and in particular you can see some yellow and red banners there that can communicate to the student where they might want to focus their efforts. With each of those, there can be a link to some recommendation on further study or further practice the student can do, tied from the learning dashboard back into the course content. Now, the student isn't the only user. I know a lot of you out there are faculty members. The nice thing about this approach is that we can aggregate over a class that same kind of information to give you a snapshot of how is your class doing on the various learning objectives and skills that you're working on with them. This display shows for a particular objective a dot plot of all the students in your class and where they are in their learning. Also on the right-hand side, there are various bars and a bar chart. Each of those represents a different skill that is a component of that learning objective. And I don't have a picture of it here, but on either of these graphs, the instructor can click and drill down further to get more details, either about the particular questions that students got right or wrong in those skill areas on the right, or further information on the individual students, both to see what they've been doing and to communicate with them. We found that instructors really appreciate the ease with which they can identify, oh, these two students are in the gray because they haven't been doing work. I wonder what's going on. I want to reach out to them. Or students who are in the red on a particular skill or learning objective, I want to reach out to them and see if there's some way I can help. So that just gives you a quick overview of what the learning dashboard looks like. We actually tested, given that this enables a very personalized learning experience, we thought it would be useful to test how much it can lead to improvements in learning. And so we've conducted this set of tests under the auspices of what we call the accelerated learning hypothesis. And so the hypothesis that we're testing is, with this kind of adaptive teaching, that is an instructor who sees that his or her students are struggling in this area but doing well in another area, doesn't need to give the standard week 2, day 3 lecture. Rather, he can tailor or adapt that lecture or recitation to the needs of the student at that point in time. So with this kind of adaptive teaching and learning, can students learn the same material as they would in a traditional course in shorter time and still show equal or better learning? So this is the question that we were asking. And we tested this in the context of 3 studies. All were conducted in the context of the Open Learning Initiative Statistics course here at Carnegie Mellon. Our first study was with a small class, an expert instructor. We wanted to start small to collect baseline data on our standard measures and to test some new dependent measures. We then replicated that with a larger class, and we also added to the second study a retention and transfer follow-up 4 months later. And then finally, we wanted to replicate and further extend our results to ask whether this same kind of benefit can be afforded to a new instructor who's not so familiar with teaching in this kind of situation. And I should say that the experimental group in each of these cases was a hybrid learning situation where the students had some face-to-face time and some time working in the online learning environment. And here's really a breakdown of the 2 conditions. The experimental group I'll call adaptive accelerated because it had adaptive teaching and we accelerated the students' learning by 2 ways. First, we had them meeting with the professor only 2 times per week instead of 4 times per week as they did in the traditional class. And if you remember at the beginning of this session, I mentioned in the 3% learning gain situation, students had 3 lectures and 1 computer lab hands-on session per week. That is what we were looking at as the control. In addition, we accelerated the experimental group by having them complete a whole semester's worth of material in 8 weeks, as opposed to at Carnegie Mellon, we have a 15-week semester. Students in the adaptive accelerated group completed their homework online and did their activities on a schedule as opposed to the more traditional reading a textbook and completing problem sets. The tests, however, were matched between the 2 groups and included both a set of in-class exams, final exam, and a standardized test of statistical reasoning called the chaos test. The key thing here is that it was the same content in both conditions, but different kind of instruction. And I just wanted to highlight that the timing was less on the adaptive accelerated group, not just for the official class time, but also we did a quick time log study to check, were the students in the adaptive accelerated group spending inordinately more time outside of class, and that wasn't the case. They were spending a little bit less there as well. If we look at the comparison of the groups in final exam performance, where many of the questions were matched, we see that the adaptive accelerated group had the highest exam scores. They were numerically higher, but not statistically different from the traditional group. And here, the traditional control is the set of students who volunteered, but they were not randomly selected into the adaptive accelerated, and traditional all is the full set of students in the traditional lecture class. So this, I'm very happy to say, is an example of us demonstrating do no harm in our intervention. We further studied students' learning gains by looking at their performance on that standardized test of statistical reasoning. And here you can see that if you look at the middle pair of bars, students pre to post test in the traditional group showed only 3% learning gain on this test. So they went from about a 50 to about a 53% correct on that test of reasoning. In contrast, students in the adaptive accelerated condition, they showed an 18% learning gain. And then I have on the very right a comparison to national norms, which is all different kinds of students from undergrads to grads who are in a statistical reasoning course and who take this same standardized test as a pre-post test. I just wanted to add that even those results are very encouraging and exciting. Students actually learned more in half the time. It wouldn't be very meaningful at all if they didn't retain that learning onto their next statistics course or whatever course in their program of study. So we did conduct a follow-up study where we did a retention and transfer analysis. And I just wanted to mention that in this follow-up, we actually did it the following semester. So the adaptive accelerated students had an even longer retention interval, as you can see here, March to mid-September, compared to the traditional students who finished their semester in May and just really had summer break as the retention interval. And here again, you can see with the newly plotted green bars, at a six-month delay, the adaptive accelerated group still scored higher on that standardized test compared to the traditional control, and that was statistically significant. In addition, we gave students open-ended data analysis problems that were scored by someone blinded to the student's condition, and there was also a significant advantage for the adaptive accelerated group here. So this is to say that when students were in a course with hybrid online and face-to-face learning with the learning dashboard, they learned more in less time. And I have a few quotes here. Basically, this is to say that students appreciated that experience. The professor, even the expert instructor who was a little skeptical at first, said that it was among the best teaching experiences he had had. And then finally, I put a quote in from David Wessel's recent Wall Street Journal article that commented on another set of evaluation studies of this course where the professors were using the learning dashboard. And this quote is a professor who found the feedback offered by the learning dashboard to be especially helpful. So that's all I had. I just want to leave you with a few take-home points. Really, we have immensely rich data available today from students' learning interactions, and these rich data are only barely being tapped. My hope and my vision is that cognitively informed models and sophisticated statistics can add value to learning analytics where we can really get access to the potential that are in those data. And I hope I've shown you from this quick example that the learning dashboard has one example or model to show how we can contribute to providing significant improvements in teaching and learning. Thank you all so much.
Marcia, that was terrific, and we've got lots of questions for you. Several questions, some of them preceded by, wow, I didn't know you were doing this work. Is the learning dashboard something people can get to, or is it only available in within Carnegie Mellon?
We are exploring extensions, so people should get in touch with me and we can talk about that. I have seen a lot of interest, and I think this is really a productive future direction. So I'm glad that their interest is piqued. Thank you for hearing that.
Excellent. I think you're going to hear from a number of people. Another theme in a number of the questions was around faculty and instructors. Such as who's teaching the faculty how to take advantage of this kind of data, how do instructors learn how to do this, some of those coming in from people tweeting online. What can you tell us about how faculty learn how to do this?
I think it's a great question, and I'm actually delighted that people are asking this because a lot of times the natural inclination is to think, you do some fancy modeling, you get some data, you get some results, and it'll automatically be well used, effectively used, easily and naturally used. And that's not always the case. One thing that we have tried very hard to do in the Learning Dashboard is to make our displays as easily interpretable and as actionable as possible. So we're trying to, from the get-go, make the interface and the visualizations speak for themselves. That said, you can have a really good picture that you can understand, okay, my students are weak in this area, strong in this area. It still can be helpful to have additional support into what do I do next. And so I think there are two key areas for that kind of support. One is, you know, I put my teaching center hat on, is that this is an area where with more personalized experiences, with data-informed teaching and learning, we have the possibility for instructors to be trying new ways of teaching. It's not anymore the standard that it's one size fits all, where every semester you give the same lectures to this new set of students. So I think seeking support in from a teaching and learning center is one good way, and that's one of the ways that I've been also helping, not just in creating and visioning this learning dashboard tool, but in working with the instructors to see how they can best use it and to make it most useful to suit their needs. The second way, I think, is that the tool itself can be a link or kind of a nexus to help instructors find the resources that would fit their students' needs, and that's something that we're exploring now. So that, like I showed you in the little quick cartoon of a student going through, that the instructor could not only see what his or her class status is, but get some suggestions and recommendations that this particular set of materials might be relevant to go over or to point your students to.
Excellent. So, Marcia, another common point of discussion for people is around engagement. And how do you really measure student engagement? Because looking at data from an LMS is maybe more of a proxy for student engagement rather than a direct way to measure it. So how do we do better at really understanding student engagement?
Also, that's a very excellent question. And in the work that I've been doing, these data have been coming from students' interactions, very rich interactions with a learning system. So it's not just that the student clicked on a page. It's that the student clicked on a page, opened a simulation, interacted with the simulation, answered some questions, got some right, got some wrong, asked for a hint, had a long pause. That richness is what we're collecting and incorporating into the data that comes into the learning dashboard. And I think that is an important piece of the picture. I think that as we go forward, comparing the depth or precision of inferences that can be gleaned from data that is much more in the rich learning experience from students compared to more proxy measures will be a future direction, so that folks know what the quality of the data and the validity of the data that they are working with.
Great. And let's switch to sort of the other side rather than collecting information, talking about the intervention process. And there are a series of questions around interventions, such as when in the process does an intervention occur? And another one is, so when do you intervene with students? When are they struggling? When do they need to be left to struggle? And sort of how do you know when to break in, I guess is the way to say it, Marcia?
Oh, that's a great question. One of the things that is an opportunity afforded by this kind of tool is that instructors start asking that question, and here's my hope, students start asking that question too. When should I keep struggling on my own? Am I on track? Having more of that reflection and self-assessment is what we really hope the Learning Dashboard will promote. So one of the things is to give students access to information on the system's estimate of how well they're learning. So hopefully that will prompt them when they see there's a mismatch, oh, I thought I was doing great. Why is the system telling me I have a weakness in this area? That mismatch might even further pull them in to explore a little further, do a little more study in that area. In terms of the instructor knowing when to intervene, I think that is also something that the Learning Dashboard can help with. What we have done is we've set it up so that the instructor gets a sort of a green, yellow, or red light for the class in terms of their learning levels for each of the objectives in a given unit. And then the instructor can gauge the levels relative to where he or she expects the students should be. So if it's in the middle of a module and the instructor is not worried that students are still developing in their learning of certain learning objectives, then he or she may decide to let it slide. But if it's getting toward the end of the unit, or if there's a particular alert that says a lot of students are showing this misconception pattern, the instructor might want to then take that information and do something sooner.
So, Marcia, one final question, even though there are many more we could ask you, and it deals with quantitative, qualitative information, and how do you use how do you measure the learning state in a discipline where it's not readily quantified? So if you think about religion, philosophy, literature, how does the dashboard calculate the estimated learning state for something that's not quantified easily?
I think where I would suggest that we start for areas like that is in terms of the course learning objectives. So if the faculty member has taken something rather abstract and seemingly hard to grapple with and has formulated that or articulated that in the form of some clear student-centered, action-oriented, measurable learning objectives, we have a really good start. From there, what the Learning Dashboard can do is it does not have to rely solely on information that's automatically scored. The idea here is that the model can take in data that come from an instructor who has maybe read a student's essay, graded it according to a rubric, and then fed that information into the Learning Dashboard. So we do have thoughts along those lines and ways to address that. I think it's a really exciting area to explore, and the scientist in me says, you know, I think it's possible and it's an empirical question. We'll see how well that works.
Well, maybe you'll have some collaborators on that.
And, terrific.
And the final thing before we move over to Ellen is just a request that you provide some references for your Learning Dashboard work, and I think lots of your other work, because people are finding this fascinating. So thank you, Marcia.
Will do. Thank you so much. Thanks, everyone.
And we're going to turn now to Ellen Wagner. And as I mentioned before, Ellen is with WCET. And one of the reasons we absolutely had to have her join us was because she's very closely involved with this project called Predictive Analytics Reporting Framework. And as I mentioned, it's a multi-institutional initiative that combines data from six institutions into a massive data set. And it's turning out to be a really invaluable resource for exploring factors that are associated with student retention and progression. So, Ellen, what can you tell us?
Well, hi, Diana. Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for joining the session today. And, Marcia, that was fantastic. I've been sitting here scrambling and taking some notes because I have a bunch of questions that I'd like to follow up with you as well. I'm going to be taking a slightly different look at this thing called learning analytics today. As Diana's mentioned, I actually come to higher education with a reasonably good pedigree, having been a tenured professor myself and working in administrative settings. But I've also been working in the commercial software world for quite a number of years. And bringing together those two perspectives at this particular time is has really helped to shape my own thinking, obviously, and in working with our WCET members about this project. I just wanted to put that on the table because this is not going to be a particularly theoretical presentation. In fact, if I were to put us on the scale, we're probably definitely on the action end, because the questions that we're looking for are going to be things like, what can we do now to look at places where students are failing and seeing what we can do with that. So to get us to that point, I want to break the session into two parts. And the first is to take a look at this notion of big data and where we are coming from generally in this orientation. And then secondly, taking a look at what this has meant for learning analytics and specifically diving into some information about PAR. So with that, this is really the basis of our thinking, the notion that data can optimize online experience. Now, I'm not saying that data necessarily makes it the best, but optimization here is really looking at, you know, how fast can a page load? How quickly can you get results working in different ways? How fast can you do your matching and modding on the fly? Many of us are familiar with a lot of commercial entities that, in fact, have taken this notion of data optimization and pushed it into realms that, well, I don't know about you all, but my given example these days is that I have a hard time going shopping on my own anymore without intelligent agents that tell me what I would really prefer to have based upon my buying patterns. It's a little scary to realize that sometimes my apps know a little bit more about what I'm doing than I might, just by virtue of the breadcrumbs that I'm leaving in my path. So we all know this. We all know what goes on in terms of our friending or our check-ins or search or personalization and some of the things that was Marcia, as Marcia was talking about, the notion of personalization. We all crave the idea of having that type of experience online. And what's getting us to that point is this notion of big data. Now, big data is a specific set of data. It's not the types of things that we normally will collect in an LMS or even in our student information systems on campus. We are talking about things in the billions and in the trillions. Terabytes, that would be with 9 zeros, or petabytes with 12 zeros, talking massive amounts of information. It's not just from education. As you can see, big data crosses all industry sectors. So this idea that education is discovering analytics is both natural, normal, and timely, because we, like every other sector, have massive amounts of information that we are leaving in our wake that we should be able to come up with ways of mining to make what we're doing work better. So quickly, the trends at play here that we are all finding ourselves dealing with, this notion of data warehouses and the cloud, it does make it possible to collect and manage and maintain massive numbers of records. I might say it also makes it possible for somebody else to manage and collect and maintain those records, which for institutions is truly a valuable asset to keep in mind, because most of us don't want to have to spend our time making sure that we have the data pools to work with. Another point that is considerably important right now is that we've got platforms that give us the power to grind through, I use the technical term, bazillions of calculations, to be able to take the numbers that we're looking at, these very large numbers, and not so much just drive down into discrete granular analyses, although one can, but even more interesting, coming up with patterns of what those numbers are saying together in ways that gives us actionability that we might not otherwise have. I would suggest that you think in terms of weather forecasting as a really great example of this. For most of us don't really think that much about weather forecasting in terms of its global sophistication. Most of us just care about weather forecasting for things like, will I need my umbrella, or is my plane going to be late? But in fact, without the ability to process worldwide, we would not have our ability to even come up with those predictive sorts of guesses at whether we should pack that umbrella with us or not. Another example data mining. I had seen some chat earlier in the session today talking about the difference between research and data mining. And let me be clear that much of what we're talking about with big data is exactly around data mining. It is looking for ways of using different types of techniques to look inside big patterns to come up with decisions about what to do about what you're seeing in those patterns. And then finally, looking at ways to anticipate behaviors and events so that you can be there and be ready and not be caught off guard continually reacting to events going on around us. This is rooted in a strategy that Gartner Research has shared with many of its IT customers around the globe, basically following the 2009 economic, shall we say, meltdown that we've all experienced, that business leaders wanted to stop reacting to events that they couldn't anticipate and wanted to try to get ahead of the curve to anticipate things. If you could see those storms, the storm clouds on the horizon, couldn't manage to get oneself inside and not be rained on quite so much. So this notion of pattern-based strategy is coming from a variety of places in institutions and enterprises of all kinds, education as well as government, financial services, you name it. Coming from traditional places like financial information and non-traditional sources such as social media, news, and blogs and things of that nature. So it's really coming around this idea of business intelligence. Business intelligence is significantly and fundamentally different from the type of research that most of us in post-secondary education have been involved with during our careers. And it's worth calling this out because I think sometimes we find ourselves using these two terms as if, you know, there is an it's either or, and that really isn't the case. We're talking here about coming up with information that helps us make better decisions about things we've got to do. And what's interesting in our particular community is that a lot of the techniques that many of us have used in doing our research over the years are not dissimilar to techniques being used for business intelligence purposes. But the questions and the way that the questions are structured really are fundamentally different. And so I think it's important to call that out. I'm sure we'll have some discussion about that as we get going here in a bit. But with all this going on, it's getting harder and harder and harder for learning organizations to say that they don't want to be a part of this kind of thing. And this is true whether we're working in universities or very large corporations with large training functions. Most of us feel very positively and strongly that learning is a personal act with which we are closely involved, and while people can help shape that learning is really ours to manage. And the idea that it can be measured in the ways that we are talking about, well, in fact, I jotted down a couple of the questions, but can we really measure creative thinking? Well, perhaps we can come up with analogs and proxies for ways in which we can get a pretty good handle on what we're doing in learning. I actually have a feeling that this is a time for learning specialists to really have their day in the sun because, after all, someone's going to have to interpret all these data to let us know what, in fact, the types of learning that is taking place. And that's where I see so much need for expertise in our communities. But I digress, and I will come back to that point here in a bit. I think the key for most of us, though, is that learning organizations, and this includes universities, cannot live outside of the demand for measurable results. And while we can sometimes see this happening more easily in places where there are easy, tangible measures that you might be able to find in IT or finance, the fact is that learning has to come up with ways of being just as accountable as we have found in organizational sectors that have an easier way of dealing with black and white measures in the things that they produce. So, if we can measure our breadcrumbs in our consumer lives, it certainly makes sense that we could measure our breadcrumbs in our learning lives. And as we've heard earlier, as I saw in the chat, and even as I've alluded today, the idea that we can do this is starting to make learning professionals like us a little uncomfortable. We're not sure where this is going to take us. And I think the question comes down to things like, will data really help us optimize educational experience? And is, in fact, optimizing education experience really even the way that we want to end up talking about this particular phenomenon? I leave that as an open question because I think we are at such an early stage in this conversation that I don't think we have too many answers about this yet. I think we have a lot of opinions and a lot of interest in coming up with answers to how we can solve, not solve the problem so much, but at least come up with explanations that make sense. And it's with that that I wanted to turn our attention quickly to baseball. It's summer. I'm a San Francisco Giants fan. I just have to throw that in just this one month when talking about baseball in the summer. There have been lessons that we can learn from the book Moneyball, just to quickly highlight it. Back in the 2002, the Oakland Athletics found themselves being highly, highly successful in baseball, much more so than their budget or the quality of their team would have suggested they would be when compared with other teams in Major League Baseball. The reason was that the Oakland Athletics had started to use a technique called sabermetrics, which allowed them to go inside the game of baseball and to analyze the points in the game where they actually won their game. So it's not so much just about the statistics of baseball. In fact, I would say that, as in education, baseball collects statistics on everything. We in education collect statistics on tons of things. The difference with sabermetrics was that rather than just using the numbers to inform opinion, such as, well, you can look at his batting average, but you can still tell that player over there, you just know it because you recognize expertise when you see it. That guy's going to be a winner. Sabermetrics took a very different approach, which was to not necessarily use the numbers to inform opinion in that same way, but to really look at the point at which games were won or lost. Things like how many bases stolen or how many bunts at bat. Places where you get into greater detail than one might normally think, but in fact, that's where the games were being won and lost. Well, once the secret got out and other teams started doing this, the athletic particular advantage here disappeared. But the fact of the matter is that it really raised the bar on performances in baseball where people could look at where games are truly won and lost. I would not necessarily suggest that education is like the game of baseball. Nonetheless, there is a phenomenon in education where we heard it alluded to even in our earlier session. It's the notion of feel. Do we feel right about some of our observations? Can we judge when a student is at risk? Well, we kind of can feel it because we have expertise. I think the issue for many of us is realizing that when we talk about that feel, it does get back to the notion of expertise. And for a lot of us, recognizing and knowing expertise when we see it is fundamental and core to how we see ourselves as professionals. Being able to better inform that with numbers seems to make a lot of good sense to me. But I think it really calls into question the fact that most of us don't like the idea that maybe our expertise is going to be called in question, and we don't necessarily want to find ourselves being trumped by a set of statistics if we know in our hearts that something is actually going to be done better in a different way. So I leave that open for some discussion. It's clearly going to be a topic of conversation for many of us working in the field for some time to come. So with that, let me turn to the PAR framework, because, in fact, it was precisely this type of thinking, not so much about baseball, but really looking inside student success and trying to figure out what we could do to really deconstruct the questions about what makes students successful and look at patterns that might inform us in ways we haven't been informed to date. What we did was to talked to a variety of WCET members who had independently been working on projects that looked at student data for different types of predictive patterns. And we asked these different schools what they thought about pooling their resources, and working within WCET, people said, well, you know, we're all part of the same organization. Sure, let's see what happens. So six schools, the American Public University and the University of Phoenix as our for-profit reps in this program. We had two four-year schools. You can see the University of Hawaii System and the University of Illinois Springfield. And we had two community colleges, Colorado Community Colleges Online and Rio Salado College from the Maricopa Community College System in Arizona. All agreed to de-identify and anonymize their student records. We put all the student records into a single data set, and we applied a variety of statistical methods to that, a descriptive, inferential, and predictive technique, according to a protocol I'll share here in a bit. We came up with over 3 million course-level records and over 640,000 student-level records. So for us, it was a chance to see if we could actually create a multi-institutional data set similar to the types of things that we've seen our commercial colleagues doing with very large data sets to see if we might be able to get inside some of these patterns for some actionable information in our particular environment. So quickly, we had it was a fairly straightforward project. We had very few big questions. One of the big questions was, what are the variables that affect student loss? Specifically, what makes students drop out? Another set of questions, what are the variables that keep people in school? And then the third question was, are there demographic variables that seem to make a difference in terms of the things that cause people to be in school or drop out? So simple in their structure, complex in their meaning, of course, but that's what drove us. And once we did that, could we figure out what would keep people in school longer? I mean, if we know what keeps people motivated, can we do more of that? If we know what gets in the way, can we do less of that? So, again, really trying to figure out what of these data made sense in terms of the patterns. And then finally, we wanted to know what types of methods actually help us do these types of examinations more completely. Remember, nobody's ever really done this type of thing before. Across schools like this. And so, our first question was, we were funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Students Project, and really the first question was, do you think you guys can actually get this to work? And we believed that we could. We had very good evidence to suggest that we could. We had several of our partner institutions with great success in doing similar things. So we believed we had a good shot at it. What's been exciting is that, in fact, we did come up with findings, and we did get this to work. And perhaps even more fun was that we found ways for we as a community to be working on creating a common set of definitions to help us do something in education, which we've not been able to do to the same degree before, which is to actually start looking for ways to prescribe treatments for different conditions that we know we're going to encounter when we talk about this great big world called remediation. Retention, progression. So I'll get to that here a little bit more. Quickly, just to give you an idea of what we did, we started by asking all the different schools what variables they actually tracked, because the first thing was we needed to find, a common set of variables that would be used by all schools. So that was number one, and we found 33 common variables across our institutions. We federated all the records of our online students. You may have noticed from the institutions that several of them are online schools. Several of them have significant online programs. We aggregated all the data into a single pool, and, of course, that meant a fair amount of harmonization. We normalized the variables to make sure that we were comparing apples to apples. And then we started applying a battery of tests that were exploratory in nature, and they ran the gamut. We basically ran through a battery of descriptive tests, inferential tests, and predictive tests so that we could get a sense of what we could find from the pattern that would otherwise not be there. Now, remember, we have been able to depend on some techniques that our partner institutions have been using in the past, so it was not just wildly going about. In fact, we had a fairly explicit way of approaching this methodologically. But the point was to get some findings, interpret the outcomes, document that so that we could go on to the next round, and then add more schools, more student records, and more variables as we were able to strengthen and validate our approach. So because I know that many of you are going to want to know what we talked about, the focus here, as you remember, were on our big questions about what causes loss, what causes momentum, so really looking at retention, progress, and completion as the goals. We used a variety of descriptive technique to really look at any trends that we could find given our large N. We used chain analyses, the decision trees, to help us look at ways in which the variables related to one another, and of course regression analysis helped us to really look at what variables seem to make a difference, and of course group differences became a part of this. Let us move on. We laugh at this point, and having been doing this work now for about a year and having just completed some of our institutional explorations since, in the first round, as I mentioned, the first question was, could we get it to work and could we find things? Well, yes, we could. And then the institutions wanted to see how they tended to benchmark against what we found with all the schools. So that's what's been going on in these last couple of months. Let me just tell you, though, about the preliminary findings. The big one is something that has a lot to do with student success and disenrollment, which is, in simple English, if you take students at risk and you make them take too many classes, they will fail. It is that simple. it is one of those types of statements that sounds fairly obvious when one says it out loud, and yet when one considers that we do have policies in place and we have benchmarks in place for institutions to focus on full-time status completion, I think what we have found is that if we know we've got an area here where we can predict student failure as cleanly as we have been able to do in this particular setting, it might get us to rethink some of the policies that we have in place that may, in fact, keep us from being able to really act upon this particular finding in particularly useful ways. We were very pleased to see that so far there is no apparent relationship between a student's risk profile and demographic variables such as age, gender, or ethnicity. The third finding that we think has enormous promise, and we are very excited to be diving much more deeply into our next round of our research. For students who are not at risk, institution-specific variables tend to predict student success. This speaks to the fact that every one of us believes our institution is special and unique and has a particular place to play, a role to play with particular types of students, and the data definitely seems to suggest that this is, in fact, the case. It raises questions such as, well, what about that notion of best practices? What if we have effective practices for different types of schools? What if we are actually able to do a better job on recommending that students find themselves attending particular types of schools to maximize the probabilities of their academic success? And what if we can take this type of information and start looking at things like enrollment management? It opens a lot of questions, things that, in fact, the PAR framework is not really necessarily all that interested in answering. We believe that these indicate pretty good opportunities for deeper research. The point is that we've got an opportunity to start taking a deeper look at some of these findings now and looking at what these patterns can tell us and what we can do about actionability is absolutely on step next. So let me just run over a couple of the lessons learned so far, and I will tell you that these are far less about the findings and far more about the implications of what we've been finding in our research so far. Analytics really are here today, and they are not going to be going any place. The idea for any one of us to not be getting on board with analytics, learning or otherwise, this is not to say that we're going to have answers emerging from the fog fully formed. We have a lot of work to do here, but the idea of being able to use numbers to track information, absolutely something that we're all going to have to get used to. And just to make the point, it's what we do with the findings that really matter. I've seen a couple of comments over here about, oh, so they're not finding some of these variables are really all that useful and interesting. And I said, well, that's absolutely not what we're saying at all. What we're saying right here is that we're finding that there are some patterns and some directions in which variables are going to speak very specifically for types of institutions and types of students. And being able to take that and have institutions use that information in practice is something that is absolutely key, but you start talking more broadly about it as a top-down generalizable finding. That just doesn't seem to make much sense. We're very, very early in our findings, and we have found that among our populations, the different schools are finding different utility from the findings we've come forward with so far. So the idea of having the lens that you need to interpret the data that makes sense for you, that's going to be a shift for us, because the idea of having a single finding, well, it's going to be how you use the information in your decision-making. And that's going to be a challenge, I think, for a lot of us, because most of us really do like to have a right answer that we can shoot for. And I think here we're going to find it's more situational than that. This is a point that I have enormous passion for, and I want to take just a moment to address this. As we are all standing on this amazing precipice of opportunity and some peril, I think, in terms of what learning analytics are going to let us do, I've never seen a time where the evidence for efficacy is more important. Having valid, reliable research upon which we can depend to do our interpretation is absolutely key, and it is a part of this conversation that must really continue to be very strong. But there is a fundamental difference between doing research on analytics and being able to take the results of our decision-making exercises and apply those to make a difference in the classroom. One of the things that's been most satisfying about PAR is that every single one of the six institutional partners has been able to take something from the findings and do something last term when we were doing the work to shift a policy or to interpret things in a particular way based upon some evidence that we believe has already had an impact on affecting the experience students have had in their classrooms. And so for us, being able to apply this information in decision-making now is as important as is doing the research to get us there in our professional literatures. So I think that this is going to be a place where we have lots of opportunities for partnerships, but I do think it's important to remember that we are talking about two sets of activities here. There's already a lot of data in higher education. I referenced that when I was talking about Moneyball here just a bit ago. The fact is that we have lots of information that we're not doing as much with as perhaps we could. Maybe there are better ways we can analyze it. Maybe there are better ways we can organize it. Maybe there are better ways we can think about it. The fact is we've got a lot of data that we can, in fact, leverage once we know what the questions are that we intend to answer. I think we are just standing at the very front end of some fascinating ways of collecting information about what actually happens in the learning experience. We've been doing a fair amount of work with game-based learning within WCET lately, and the part that we're fascinated with is when you can actually see the patterns of transactions in a game-based setting and can use those to anticipate different types of learning events, it really opens some possibilities in, I think, some fairly interesting ways to see what one can do about anticipation of support for learning at the point of need. Very interesting opportunities. The idea of living under the sort of data, I've just been to a reference of a quick story. Douglas Bowman was at one point the lead designer at a company called Google, and he quit in quite a huff back in 2009, wrote a blog post about it, and his reason for leaving was that he was tired of living in an environment where he, as a designer, was living under the sort of data that was imposed upon him by the usability engineers that would, in fact, take his designs and tell him that users, in fact, preferred a 5-pixel line to a 3-pixel line, or would make him choose from among 42 different shades of blue. I think there are lessons here for many of us in education, because while we certainly appreciate the value that analysis brings to our discipline and that analytics can bring to our practice, the fact is that a lot of us aren't necessarily all that comfortable with having that information hanging over our heads. I think it is going to force us to think very differently about what we do, and let's be clear, there will be ways in which we do our work differently as a result of the transparency that these numbers will bring to our practice. And with that point, I should say that there really is no such thing as sort of transparent. Once you open the Pandora's box of data, it is open. Anybody can see it. It's a bit like standing on a scale in the middle of a room. And I don't know about you, but most people I know aren't particularly comfortable with that, with the image of that experience. And yet, being able to use those numbers in productive ways, in fact, can increase our own institutional health in ways that we would like to anticipate. So I think we will see how we evolve on this particular point. And ultimately, I think we have just really started to understand the true power that analytics brings to the learning enterprise. Now, I should say that lest anyone think that I am necessarily jumping up and down with glee about some of these findings, I will tell you that like many of us, I consider the consequences of some of these things that we're doing and finding my own practice being shifted right now. It's a little daunting to think about doing this work in the different ways in which we are going to be expected. And yet, what concerns me perhaps more than anything is that I fear having these types of data and techniques used, done unto us, as opposed to our having our hand in managing our own destiny around where learning analytics will take us. I think it is very, very, very bright futures. And of course, we're going to have to get our skills up to deal with it. Thankfully, we've got activities like the Sprints to help get us there. But I think we've got interesting times ahead. I'm excited to be a part of it, and I'm looking forward for all of us raising the bar on what we can do to improve student success with data. So, Diana, with that, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Okay. So let me ask some different categories of questions, Ellen. first, some definitional clarification kinds of questions. For example, can you share what the 33 common variables were?
I can, although for me to read them to you here in the sprint would probably
Agreed.
Not make a lot much sense. A lot of sense. We have actually published an article in the Journal of Asynchronous Learning Networks, JALN, that has much of the methodological information contained in the journal. So for those of you who really do want to dive more deeply into what the heck the crazy people were actually doing with this stuff, I refer you to that article. And what I will do immediately following this particular session is to make sure that I gather links and assets so that everyone can find what they would like. But there is a JALN article. The variables have been published. And as soon as I'm not trying to talk, write notes, and watch my screen for comments, I will be happy to pass that information on.
Perfect. And we can pop that into the information that we share with people first thing tomorrow as a recap as well. So what about how you defined at risk? How were the students categorized as at risk, Ellen?
The at risk tended to be seen below. We really tried to not put a lot of nuance in the types of variables that when we were looking at things like C and below, that seemed to make the difference. And it was also in their time, the likelihood of dropping out within a particular time following the first data pools and then tracking backwards to find those variables. Does that help?
Yes. Yes, it does.
Okay.
And one other clarification question, did you look at finances as a reason for disenrollment?
We did not. This was first pass through. In fact, while we're talking, I'm going to see if I can just pull up one of these, but at least I could reference some of the variables. They were really fairly common types of things. I mean, the common things that you would expect. And we know that finance matters. As we go forward into our next round, we are looking very, very seriously at ways in which we can come up with some proxies for finance. But at this point, it was the first pass-through were things like grade point. They were things like numbers of credits completed, numbers of credits not completed, military status, fairly common things that, again, for us, looking at what happens at these things in combination was more about the pattern that they would generate rather than diving down to a particular granular type of numeric finding. So looking for different kinds of things than what I'm seeing people asking about here in some of the questions that I've scanned as I've looked back at the list.
So moving away from clarifications now to how do we make this actionable, you talked about some of your findings that students who take too many courses and they're at risk, that increases their risk of failure. And the question is, or the observation is, that students are often required to take a minimum course load, of course, to qualify
Yep.
for financial aid. And the financial aid is absolutely critical for those students. So how would you address your findings with financial aid policy or how we support students while, they've got the financial need, yet they can't take a full course load?
Well, the gloriousness of being involved in doing the research is that we have been able to surface this particular finding and we have been able to call the question. What happens at this point is, in fact, a very interesting policy implication that, we on the PAR framework team are not likely to pick that one up and run with it ourselves. We are making sure that this finding is found available, and I'm very glad that, in fact, the question was raised with you, Diana, because it's one of those aha moments like, oh, my gosh, if we have a problem with financial aid policy in this country, it is tied to full-time status. We have evidence to suggest that maybe this isn't the way to do it. Wow, perhaps we should do something different in terms of what this means. We need to get more numbers involved. I will say right now that
We did this research with 6 schools. There are more than 4,000 schools in the United States. For us to make a lot of deep generalizations from what we have found so far would, I think, be both naive and irresponsible. So we are going to be adding schools. We've got 10 schools lined up to do the next round. We want to be able to get to 1 million student records this time and hopefully 5 million course records. Again, it will give us more confidence in the things that we're finding. And at that point, you can be sure it'll be a lot easier to be able to say, excuse us, but no, we've got something here we need to take a look at. We're going to find the same kinds of things here. I'm going to jump ahead to where this implication matters for what we will be doing with it next, because it comes back to a finding we came up with, where you don't have a common data model for assessing risk across the ecosystem. It's really hard to get consistent findings. If you don't have consistent findings, it's really difficult to have solutions. If you don't have a way of evaluating the efficacy of a retention solution relative to others, you don't know if what you're doing is any better than hit or miss. So I think the bigger findings for us than perhaps of all is that without a common data model, it is going to be very difficult for us to be consistent in our ability to prescribe treatments for different conditions that together make up this condition called retention or progression. That there are, you know, the things that force people to drop out. I'm looking ahead to days when people will say, my gosh, I have a retention app that you can use with your students to keep them in school longer. And I'm going to want to know, well, how is that particular retention app going to compare, be used to diagnose a particular type of condition present in some students, and how am I going to know if it's any better than just, putting a Band-Aid on a headache? We're just at such an early stage right now that we owe it to ourselves to do a better job of defining what we think is going on around us, coming up with definitions that work collectively, a data model that works collectively, and use that as a way of doing some true diagnoses where we can actually scale and we can actually have some impact.
So, Ellen, you're implying that we are going to want, as campuses, to pool our data so that we've got more data to test against. And are there things besides common data definitions that we ought to be preparing for now so that we can conduct these analytics projects tomorrow?
I think institutions may find that there will be value for them to put their data into common frameworks where they might be able to, in fact, benchmark themselves against other institutions either like them or different from them. I think that there are going to be some interesting diagnostic opportunities that come from that. Do I think everyone should do it? Well, I think there is value in being able to see where you might benchmark yourself. I think there are going to be institutions that believe they would prefer to do more of their work within the confines of their own institutions. And rather than looking at themselves across multiple institutions, either like themselves or different in other ways, that maybe they feel as if taking care of doing their own analysis with inside is going to serve their particular needs. I'm not sure I feel comfortable saying that one way is better than another. I think it depends on why one is diving into those analytical examinations, if in fact it is to help inform decision making to make the campus feel like they're doing a better job.
Well, Ellen, there are lots of additional questions and discussions that you have kicked off and hope we'll continue to participate in, but thank you very much both for the work that you're doing and the insights that you've shared with everyone. And I want to ask all of you to join me in thanking both Marcia and Ellen for what they have shared today. And before you sign off, please take a moment to click on the session evaluation link. We would really like to know how this is working for you. And if you missed any part of today's conversation, or if you want to see some or all of it again, it'll be archived on the EDUCAUSE Sprint website, including the slides and a complete replay of the session. And I hope you will join us right now on idea scale for our conversation hub so that we can continue today's conversation. And you can access idea scale, by the way, from the Sprint website. So thank you all for joining us today. I hope to see many, many of you tomorrow in the third and final day of the Analytics Sprint. This is Diana Oblinger. Thank you for joining us.
Ellen, you still there?
I still am here. You bet.
Good job. Wow.
Marcia
here too?
I hope she's here. It's kind of hanging out because, of course, I'm sitting here. I'm scrolling through here. I want to copy and paste so I can answer all these darn things. It's hard to do that when you're
I just sent the note, the question history to myself and the chat history, so I can forward that to both of you if you want. Because there was just a lot of great comments and questions and things that I'm sure you'll want to have. So if you want them.
I absolutely would because, a lot of the stuff I was trying to get through today didn't get a chance to talk at some of these things. Like I saw somebody like, what institutional issues, ha ha. It's like, yeah, it's like what is a four-year school or a community college? That made a difference. And that's institutionally specific. They would love to hear if it was for profits or 4-year, and in fact, it wasn't. So I just decided not to stir that particular bag of burning coals. It was just it's easier. Anyway, but I do want to have a chance to respond. So I would love to see that.
Okay. All right. I will send those to you. And there were a lot of good resources posted too. And
great.
So, and people just. I think it's the first, well, for me, it's the first time that I have really, the PAR project and what Marcia's doing, I think are just two of the most exquisite examples of what you can do with the data and just such great practical applications. And so I think people are still struggling finding their way, but the vision is there, the practicality is there, and I think that they just need some help figuring it out.
Well, a lot of people aren't going to figure it out. I mean, the thing I've come to realize is that there are going to be people who will lock their knees and say, I'm not going to do this forever. And that is their, and that's fine. We've still got people now who are just, don't you find it just a tad sort of funny in a way that we are just now reaching a point where online learning has just tipped into public consciousness?
Yeah.
And even if it has, that it's like people are giving away stuff for free and that's what people think online is, it's like, oh, for crying out loud. No, but it has now tipped, and that's fine. If it takes us 10 years for this to tip, I won't be terribly surprised. We will have iterations, but it's going to take a long time for this. It's a fundamental shift in how people do their work.
Oh, absolutely. And what I guess when I started in online learning some time ago, I always maintained that online learning would change face-to-face learning.
Oh, yeah.
And here's another demonstration of it. We know so much more about student behavior and, you know, can start to look at, you know, where we can interject and make some changes and things like that than we do about the face-to-face. You know, it's just, it's amazing to me. So, anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I will send these to you.
Great.
I'm not quite sure how quickly I get. I think I get them fairly quick, or maybe that Vic has to save them. But and sometimes they go into my spam folder, and I have to save them. But I will get them off to you today or tomorrow. So
that would be
really
great. That would be great because I was in the midst of copying them and I got kicked out of the webinar. So
I got kicked out too. So let's get them very quickly. I decided I better. Vic probably saved him too, but I thought I'd better email myself really quickly. So let me go in and see if I've got him right now.
Okay, okay.
And I haven't had time to dig into the badging and all of that stuff. I know you had sent us, and I intended to get in there, but I've been consumed with this sprint. So.
Oh yeah. Well, it's. I mean, I have. In fact, I was on vacation last week and spent much of last week in a U-Haul driving across America. So my. I did not think about games at all this week, except for the Tetris-like game of getting the boxes to fit into the back of the truck.
So where were you moving?
I was moving some things from my mother's home in northern Wisconsin. We were sort of finally getting around to sort of settling things among the kids. And so I went back to gather my couple of things that I wanted to bring back of hers to California, and it wasn't a lot, but it was stuff I had to go back and take care of personally. So as long as I had to fly back anyway, we just decided to make an adventure of it. And
so where in northern Wisconsin? Because I'm from Minnesota, and my husband's from Wisconsin, and we had a lake home in Wisconsin. So when I
Well, I am from Sturgeon Bay, which is about 40 miles northeast of Green Bay.
I know where that is. Yeah, I have. We've got places up in Door County.
Yep, well, that's exactly where my relatives. I am a sixth generation Door County girl who has escaped from Wisconsin and moved to California. So of course they're not quite sure what happened to me. But,
I know I'm the only one who left Minnesota for Florida. So it's sort of like, aren't you coming back?
You know? And they don't understand that once you lose the frigid cold gene, that there's no getting it back.
I know. My brother says, you don't think you'll ever move back? And I go,
No, and I know I won't. And that actually had some to do with things that I would bring back because there will be items that will stay in the family. And so those did not get moved to California. That's, I was actually, you know, realized that once stuff gets out here, there will be no, I mean, it's here. It becomes, it's Californian.
Yeah.
So,
well, I left the toboggan with my brother. So.
Oh, there you go. Very good.
Oh, dear. All right. Well, this was great. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the invitation. I feel like I should go sniff around a little bit, see what they're saying so that I can respond.
Yeah.
And,
well, and I think Diana was interested in doing some follow-up. You know, as we had a little session yesterday, and I mean, and the same today, there were so many comments and questions that, you know, there's just no way that every, you know, anyone could get to them all. And so maybe there were some follow-ups that we could do in terms of responding to those, because a lot of great questions. So.
Well, and I wanted to take a quick pass. So I think if I get out there on the site, do you happen to have that link handy?
To Idea Scale or?
Yeah.
It's
Idea Scale, educause.edu,
yeah,
right?
Let me. I just went and got it. Oh, here's an email I've got. I'll forward this to you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm sure I probably got it, but.
No, I'm not sure if you did or not. So let me forward this to you, and go get some good wine or something.
Yay!
After that.
Yeah. There we
you
go.
You deserve it. It was awesome. So.
Well, thanks. That was fun. I appreciate it, and we'll talk soon.
Yeah, I'm going to be coming to WCET this fall.
Oh, great. I would look forward. I would love that. That would be wonderful.
I hope so. So we'll see. I think it's the week before our annual conference, so it would be a mad, wild time. But anyway, if I can make it work, I'll be there.
That would be fantastic. Well, thanks again. This was great. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ellen. Bye-bye.
See you. Bye.